music time in Africa.
Chisambi changoko
mbira mama imesa kakayimba kakoko
baila mosi te quiero baila mosi te quiero give it to me
baby nkwata bulungi baby nkwata bulungi omukwano we kuli mubungi
baby mi amor
baby nkwata bulungi
baby nkwata bulungi
omukwano we kuli mubungi
Africa.
Awesome.
Tune in online for the live stream Fridays at 900 and Saturdays and Sundays at 900, 15, 20 and 2200 Universal Time. Go to voanews.com and click listen. Then choose VOA Africa.
All right. Hello. I hope you enjoyed that triple play of current hits from Ghana and Cameroon and Uganda. I'm Heather Maxwell and we're at the bottom of the hour now. Coming up is our second interview in today's show, an in-depth one with Aline Wad, the Paris-based Senegalese jazz powerhouse showcased at last month's International Jazz Day concert at the United Nations in New York. And he's also just released his new album called Sultan and is currently on tour with that album in Africa and Europe. He joined me by Skype earlier this week to speak with me about all that, and we'll listen to some samples from his new album and also from that live jazz concert where he plays and sings John Lennon's classic Imagine, plus an original tune called High Life with American jazz legends like Herbie Hancock, Marcus Miller, and others. But first, before we get to Aline, let's listen to this classic desert blues from 2007 by the group Tenari Wen. It's called Cher Achel. In poetic Tamashek, the language of the Tuareg people, the lead singer expresses his intense love for both his woman and for his desert country.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. That was Tinari Wen from Mali with Cher Achel. I'm Heather Maxwell, and now it's time to meet Alune Wad. We begin with about a minute of one of the tracks off of his new album, Sultan. It's called Donso. And we will come back to listening to that and talking about it at the end of our conversation. But then, after this first minute of Donso, we will go straight into my interview with Alune that was recorded earlier this week. So sit back, stretch out, and enjoy the Alune Wad world of jazz.
So nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
The song Imagine, which we all know, just blew me away, especially when you started singing in Wolof, I think it was, and I'm like, wait, is that English? Is he mixing up the words? What's happening? And then I realized you were taking it to a different level, starting with you. Then the whole tune became very international and had a really broad global scope. So what was it like for you to perform that piece?
You know, I think that piece makes really a sense, and to play it, first of all, to play it nowadays with all this trouble we have all over the world, playing this piece with different people, different artists who come from all over the world. That was very intense and exceptional for me. And playing inside of UN, you know. We all know the piece from John Lennon, but we are arranged by the jazz version by Herbie Hancock. And they play it for every jazz day. They make it like final.
Like the anthem. Final,
yeah. It was an emotional part for me. Playing and with all these fantastic musicians were very special for me.
You are one of the greatest jazz musicians in the world right now. You come from Senegal. How did that happen? What forces do you think have brought you to where you are right now?
Because I think I'm not thinking about if I am the greatest or if I am not one of the greatest. I'm just, you know, playing what I want, what I feel.
What brought you to music in the first place? Have you always been driven by wanting to compose and perform and sing?
You know, I start music very early. When you start music at 6 or 8 years old, you don't have really the same vision to the other guy who start music at 18 years old.
Yes, as that young boy at 6 or 8, what got you started?
No, because my father was musician also. He was the conductor of the Senegalese Philharmonic Orchestra in the military, in the army, and studied in France in the Conservatoire de Paris in the 70s. He introduced me classical music, the formation with Jean-Sébastien Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, all this. I know it because he plays this music every day at home. The traditional music by my mom, because that was the music she loved to listen. Mm-hmm. The pop music with my sisters, and the reggae and jazz music with my uncle. Then I was surrounded by music, by different music and different musical mm-hmm. education. That was, for me, the choice was very natural.
You did another piece with Marcus Miller, two bass players, the greatest bass players in the world, in the jazz idiom.
Oh, great.
What was that piece?
That piece was composed by Marcus Miller from the Marcus Miller's album, who calls Aphrodisia. I was the musical director of this piece in studio.
Okay.
And I sing also, because it was the beginning, you know, Marcus was really, you know, looking for the African music, West African music, because, you know, he's ambassador of UNESCO about the slave story. You know, he wanted to make a piece or kind of tribute to African music. I used to work with him on this album for, I think, 3 pieces. This was the hit of the album.
What is the title of the song?
Highlight.
I really loved it, and you guys looked like you were just so comfortable together, but that explains it, because you actually are.
Yeah, we were very comfortable. You know, it's not very sometimes easy to mix 2 bass players on stage, because you're supposed to play on the same frequency on bass.
So your new album, Sultan, track 2, Donso, it's like a trip. Here's what I hear in it. I hear Mali, Fula flutes, the Bambara Mande Donson. Then I hear Ethiopian melodies, especially with the horns. And then about 3 minutes in, the time, it gets like double time. There's a total different groove. And then I'm hearing you singing in Wolof, and the choruses then come in. They sound Brazilian. It sounds like we're smoothly transported to Brazil. And then in the end, I even hear a tiny bit of sort of soukous style, very subtle at the end. So this piece to me was just blew me away. Tell me about that tune.
This piece is an African piece. You just transcribe all the story of the piece. And this piece is the face of the album, the story of the album. She is the piece which represents really the album, the story of the album, Sultan.
It's what we call in American English, it's a road trip.
Road trip, exactly.
Say goodbye. What would you like to tell our listeners and our viewers about your new album?
I hope they will listen to it, because I know, of course, if they listen to it, they will love it. They will all found their joys or their own story inside of this music, inside of this album. This is not a Senegalese album or African album. This is an album for human beings.
Alun Wad, thank you so much.
Thank you, my dear. Thank you to give me this opportunity to talk with your audience, to talk with the American and African people audience. And thank you for everything you have done for music, and you're still doing for music.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Just like you, I'm in love with music.
Donso by Alun Wad. I hope you enjoyed that interview with the artist. I'm Heather Maxwell. This is Music Time in Africa, and I have three more current jams for you to round out the hour, starting with this one. It's called Wanguru by Calligraph Jones from Kenya and featuring Tanzanian singer Ali Kiba.
Ikona gari na bebe shamatri. Madem misare tuna beba for free. My boy wangare kauja tripa mingi. Pekuko shware ime bidyo meti. Cause make a nice pass you pick a mandu. Hizi baraka ni zote za Mungu. Mali safi twe klasma akwe wangu. Wangu ujumi ni mse wangu. Wangu mindo hule tanga buru. Na vile na waroga tama ni juju. Sijai kuwa mnyonge mimi ni sugu. Agesu jai jua omolo na kiba wanga mandugu. Niko na pesa na show mina lipwanga mita na nusu. Company pressure batu najua wana lipo marupu. Mashoja meweze batu toba Kenya wote ni wasuku. Bale otuko bongo na lazima mini tapita na mutu. Niko na gari na bebe shama three. Madem nisare tunabeba for free. Maboy wangare kauja tripa mingi. Pekuko shware ime video meti. Cause make a nice pass you pick a mandu. Hizi baraka ni zote za Mungu. Mali safi penglas ma akwe wangu. Wangu ujumi ni mse wangu.
Chop chop, money chop chop now. You give me more, you make it clap clap clap. No many valia, Gucci and G-string. Girl, I'm not used to that, you kill me. No sense at tupa, kill not tupa. Show them you can tupa, kill not tupa. Girl, you not even sana. Oh my girl, you not even sana.
Niko na gari na bebe shama three. Madem misare tuna beba for free. My boy wangare kauja tripa mingi. Pekuko shware ime video meti.
Cause make a nice pass you pick a mandu. Hizi baraka ni zote za Mungu. Mali safi penglas ma akwe wangu. Wangu vuju mini mse wangu. Mini mse wangu vu mse wa power. Ndoku we this I piga teina dawa. Yeah down a tei. Makarao pa milango bata wana say. Wanataka juwa kana tumi yanga madrei. Lit kila siku ni kani mipananga bay. Nipate zaba juu ya shisha mitisha mana blaze. Na kila siku ni mazishi mi ulala kwa grey. Niko na tiba chuko pali za Dodoma tuna nice pa shere. Tuna malizia Dar es Salaam. Mali safi kani safi kuna aje ya in. Tuna jitokeza nikisema abari madam. Anataka juwa kani mejipin. Mina sema yes bana. Na siati nimekarima gun. Anajua kunifanya ile kitu. Na kila miu teka kuenda yufanya kali yoto.
Niko na gari na beba shama three. Madem misare tuna beba for free. My boy wangare kauja tripa mingi. Pekuko shware ime video meti.
Cause make a nice pass you pick a manduru. Hizi baraka ni zote za Mungu. Mali safi penglas ma akwe wangu. Wangu vujumini mse wangu.
Yeah, that was Calligraph Jones from Kenya. And now to Nigeria with Burna Boy's latest, Last Last.
You go powerful to preserve though. Nothing to discuss, cause I think we're by default. I'm without any doubt, though. I'm a me, I be a doubt, though. I know go feed the girl. I know go feed the girl, it's out, though. I'm a mind that's really tough, though. I put my life into my job, and I know I'm in trouble. She manipulate my love, oh.
moto, one Toyota Corolla. My feelings been this swing like Django Lover. Feelings been this swing like Django Lover. Now you crash your Ferrari for Lekki Bona. Now some money remake could have been all over. My feelings did this swing like Django Lover. Feelings did this swing like Timbani catch you, at you. I'm a white dog. For you, and if I do anything you want me to do, Timbani get you, at you. I'm a white dog in Venice. Why you say I did nothing for you? And if I do anything you want me to do, maybe another time, maybe another life, you will be my wife and we'll get it right. We don't cast, last, last. Now everybody go chop breakfast. Have to say bye.
Yes, oh man, that's awesome. That is Burna Boy's latest, Last Last. I'm Heather Maxwell, and this is our final song today. It's called Friday Feeling by Chimano from Kenya. Let's get it.
That Friday feelings come again. Only good vibes and energy. We're gonna dance the night away. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Tell somebody, love to patane kileleni. To karibishe wageni. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. I'm setting myself free. Ring the authorities. Shit talking jealousy won't take a toll on me. This is not your normal party. This is Vogue, there's a dress code. Every corner's getting flashy. Stay wise, stay woke. Utani pata kati kati. If you know, I guess you know. Every color on my mind, I'm gonna let it out tonight. That Friday feeling's come again. Only good vibes and energy. We're gonna dance the night away. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Tell somebody, love to patane kileleni. To karibishe wageni. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Na 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 na, na 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 na. Oh oh. Excuse my behavior, please. I've let loose my boundaries. I'm on a trip, my trip's on a trip. Look how you got me high. I wanna touch somebody. I wanna love somebody. It's been my prayer. Join if you dare. Let's let it out tonight. That Friday feeling's come again. Only good vibes and energy. We're gonna dance the night away. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Tell somebody. Love to patane kileleni. To karibishe wageni. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Oh oh. That Friday feeling's come again. Only good vibes and energy. We're gonna dance the night away. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Tell somebody. Love to patane kileleni. To karibishe wageni. Me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Oh oh. Friday feelings come again. Come on. Only good vibes and energy.
Hell yeah.
We're gonna dance the night away. Me and my crew gon'
Yes, all right. And with Friday Feeling by Chimano, it is time to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to see you back here again next week. Also, a big thank you to Prince Benjamin and his guests from Ghana, to Alun Wad from Paris, and to UNESCO and the Herbie Hancock Institute of Jazz for all contributing to today's program. Music Time in Africa broadcasts live on shortwave and on select local FM stations every Friday and Saturday and Sunday. You can also find it online at voanews.com. Just search for me, Heather Maxwell, or Music Time in Africa. Till next time, stay beautiful and stay safe.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. An air raid siren was heard in central Kyiv shortly after Polish President Andrzej Duda finished speaking to Ukraine's parliament, a reminder that the nation remained at war, even as the front lines have shifted hundreds of kilometers to the south and east after ending weeks of resistance by the last Ukrainian fighters in the strategic southeastern port of Mariupol. Russia is waging a major offensive in Luhansk, one of two provinces in Donbas. The Russian Defense Ministry said Sunday its forces pounded Ukrainian command centers, troops, and ammunition depots in Donbas and another region in the south with airstrikes and artillery. Belarusians are among the foreign fighters who have volunteered to take up arms in Ukraine against Russian forces. They consider the Ukrainians defending their homeland to be their brethren. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Japan Sunday as part of his first visit to Asia as president. During the Japan leg of Mr. Biden's trip, he will meet with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Monday and lay out his vision for negotiating a new trade agreement, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. A central theme for the trip is to tighten U.S. alliances in the Pacific to counter China's influence in the region. Prior to Japan, Mr. Biden was in South Korea, where he thanked U.S. and South Korean service members, telling them they represent the strength of the U.S.-Korea alliance.
Our alliance was formed through shared sacrifice of the Korean War, and now, seven decades later, thanks to you, Republic of Korea is strong, thriving, and innovating democracy, and our alliance grows stronger every single day because of you all.
For the latest on where the president is and what he's doing, please visit us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Scientists who have monitored the monkeypox virus in Western Africa are baffled by its recent spread around the world. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Cases have previously been seen only among people with links to Africa. But in the past week, cases have popped up in Britain, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, the US and Canada. Most of the reported infections have been found in young men who hadn't previously travelled to Africa. No one has so far died from the outbreak, and scientists in Britain are investigating whether the disease is being sexually transmitted. I'm Karen Chamas.
Austria's first suspected case of monkeypox has been reported in Vienna, national broadcaster ORF said Sunday, citing a spokesperson for the city's top health official. The 35-year-old man was taken to the hospital overnight with symptoms typical of the disease, ORF said, adding that tests should determine whether it really is monkeypox by Sunday night. Oman announced Sunday the lifting of all measures that had been taken to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in all venues and for all activities, state TV reported, citing a statement from the government committee dealing with the pandemic. Northeast Bangladesh's worst flood in nearly 20 years began receding Sunday, but rescue workers were struggling to help millions marooned by extreme weather across the region that has killed around 60 people. Floods are a regular menace to millions of people in low-lying Bangladesh and neighboring northeast India, but many experts say that climate change is increasing the frequency, ferocity, and unpredictability. The fourth round is underway at the PGA Championship without its star attraction. AP correspondent Dave Ferry reports on who's missing from one of the four men's major championships in professional golf and why.
Tiger Woods is three and out at the PGA Championship. PGA of America officials announced that Woods has withdrawn from the tournament at Southern Hills in Tulsa after a 9-over 79 left him 12-over and 21 shots off the lead. Woods limped through the round in obvious pain as he continues to deal with the after effects of major surgery on his right leg. The 15-time major champion barely made the cut at 3-over on Friday, thanks to a pair of late birdies and a 1-under 69. This marks the first time Woods has withdrawn from a major event since turning pro. I'm Dave Ferry.
And recapping our top story, an air raid siren was heard in central Kyiv shortly after Polish President Andrzej Duda finished speaking to Ukraine's parliament, a reminder that the nation remained at war even as the front lines have shifted hundreds of kilometers to the south and east. Russian-backed separatists already controlled parts of Luhansk and the neighboring Donetsk province before the invasion, but Moscow wants to seize the remaining Ukrainian-held territory in the region. By remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The public is expecting so much from him because the buck stops at him. While we may indeed expect these law enforcement agents and SCB to act, but obviously we would also want to hear his words on these final findings, and obviously should be able to address the nation.
Malawi civil society and human rights groups demand an inquiry into a report detailing corruption in the government allocation of funds to combat the coronavirus.
And we have those that are prepared to go and set it up for themselves while they are being held on two hands by the SME ministry, the science and technology ministry, as well as the local government ministry that is providing the resources through the CDF.
Zambia's Minister for Labor and Social Security says the administration is implementing measures to create meaningful jobs for the youth.
7 to 15 years, we shouldn't be surprised if China moves ahead and establishes more military facilities on the continent. It should not come as a surprise, judging from the current trajectory of Chinese interest and the expansion of Chinese activities on the continent.
An analyst or expert say it appears China is considering establishing a second naval base in Africa on the Atlantic coast. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Malawi, civil society and human rights groups are demanding an immediate investigation into a report detailing corruption in the government allocation of funds to combat the coronavirus. This after an audit showed that about $4.7 million of the $21 million of funds to help stop the spread of the disease cannot be accounted for. It adds to the $881 million that could not be accounted for in the first phase of the 2021 study. The findings were contained in a report compiled by Malawi's Auditor General. The groups say those responsible for the alleged misappropriation of funds should be held accountable for their actions. They argue that the alleged embezzlement contributed to COVID-related deaths at the height of the pandemic. Meanwhile, President Lazarus Chakwera has vowed to crack down on those he says are responsible for the alleged graft. For more reaction, I reach Robert Nkwazalemba. He is the chairperson of the Human Rights Consultative Committee.
So there are a number of NGOs that have risen to say we would want action to be done. You may wish to recall that an initial report was released earlier this year, and there were some talks, but government said we would want to wait until we get a final report from the Auditor General. And then some people were suspended, others arrested, some district commissioners. But with this final report being out and confirming the initial report findings, people are saying heads must roll.
Should the Anti-Corruption Bureau, tasked with investigating financial malfeasance or the embezzlement of public funds, be in charge of this? Because sometimes some people say that the anti-corruption group is being used to persecute opponents of the administration. So who should
tackle this investigation?
Well, it's on two flanks. You have abuses based on issues to do with subsistence allowance. That is, people being paid the multiple allowances for perhaps for not doing anything. And then you have other issues to do with misprocurements, where you have state entities, the internal procurement committees, colluding to defraud government either by giving false figures or inflated figures. So obviously there are two elements. You have the police have to deal with perhaps the issue of subsistence allowance claims, and then you have to further do investigations and prosecute institutions that are involved in misprocurements, that is the inflation of figures and the like. They need to find out what was the motive, who was behind it, so that they are brought to book. So if such issues are brought to police, they, to an extent, lack capacity to understand the motive behind such misprocurements. Because if there is collusion, parties spoke and they agreed to supply others, and then you also get to find some decisions that were made midway. They were assigned, the initial project was to procure medicine, drugs, issues of sanitizer. But midway, they changed the focus of what the money should be used for. So the person behind the decision to say, can we change course of the project, those people have to be brought to book. So yes, SCB has to be involved. It may have been overstretched or it is being overstretched, but it has to come in on those aspects. Well, police also have to do their part. So we would not want to agree with the elements that perhaps SCB is being used to persecute individuals, maybe from the previous administration, if that may be put in that context. But would like to say we understand SCB has moved fast on a few individuals, political individuals, simply because there is evidence that is available. Corruption prosecution is not a small task. So where they have evidence and confirm the trail of abuse or corruption, that's why they have moved fast. And unfortunately, it seems to be addressed to those individuals that were in the previous administration. That's how it's being misunderstood. But we do appreciate and understand that SCB is working based on the information that they have so far gathered on such allegations.
President Lazarus Chakwera has vowed to crack down. What are the expectations of him to undertake this promise to crack down on those responsible for the alleged embezzlement?
Obviously, he may not want to be seen to be overacting his responsibilities. He believes in the high five, where the rule of law is one arm of his principles. So he would want state institutions to undertake action. Initially, when he acted, where he fired some district commissioners and the like, the magistrate courts found them not wrong and they were reinstated. Obviously, people would have concluded that the president acted wrongly, overstepped his mandate. So we are seeing a scenario where he would say, I tried my part, but the system, justice system, let me down. These people were cleared. So based on the final report, let the law enforcement agents act. So obviously, you'll be looking at the police to prosecute and the SCB to take up those matters that are involving individuals where corruption has been detected. So I would say he maintains his stand that he is very club on corruption. The public is expecting so much from him because backstops at him. While we may indeed expect these law enforcement agents and SCB to act, but obviously we would also want to hear his words on these final findings, and obviously should be able to address the nation.
Robert Nkwazalemba is the chairperson of the Human Rights Consultative Committee. He spoke with me from Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. Zambia's Minister for Labour and Social Security says President Hakainde Hichilema's administration has implemented measures to recruit 30,000 teachers and 11,000 nurses before the end of the year. Brenda Tambatamba says he has created an enabling business environment to
to encourage Zambians to invest and to attract foreign investors in mining and other sectors of the economy. Her remarks follow President Hakainde Hichilema's call for a concerted effort to improve the operating environment of the mining sector. His call came during a speech at the annual African Mining Indaba, recently held in Cape Town, South Africa. For more on the labor market in Zambia, I reached Zambia's Labor and Social Security Minister Brenda Tamba Tamba via Skype. In part two of my interview with her, Tamba Tamba addresses concerns by youth groups that government is failing to keep its promises to quickly create jobs for them.
We have got a responsibility to take Zambia out of the doldrums of the debt situation that the PF government entrenched this nation in. So social safety net, managing the debt situation, which is would became almost unsustainable. And so we've checked, we have assessed, we've done risk assessments, possible ideas of the best way to manage the debt situation. And so we are negotiating a program with the IMF to restructure the debt so that it doesn't obstruct our agenda to cater to the needs of our people, to creating the jobs that are so much needed. So our people are being communicated to, including communicating to them about the alternatives that are in place that they can utilize in the short term and the midterm while we are pursuing more sustainable long-term economic recovery measures that will yield the kind of jobs, the meaningful jobs that have been demonstrated in the jobs that have been provided, procured for the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education and many more, including the fact that we are also looking at the social security packages of those that have gone without their pensions during the same time, the past 10 years, who were never paid their pension.
What entails in this safety net? And for those who are not in the health or education industry where the jobs have been created, like you mentioned, what happens to them?
The SME Development Ministry is seated there together with the Ministry of Science and Technology to ensure that they provide a framework for training, for upskilling those that are wishing to go into self-employment.
What kind of training?
Vocational training.
Okay.
Yes, vocational skills training. And so this is the framework that we have, the two ministries are working together with the Ministry of Labor and Social Security, my ministry, to ensure that we are also catering to those that may be crossing from formal employment to go and set up their small businesses that will grow eventually. And that is also complemented by the CDF, the Constituency Development Fund, that has grown exponentially, unprecedented growth of that fund from 1.6 million kwacha to 25 million kwacha. This money has two components that these who are being trained can tap from. By the way, there's a component that can give a bursary, that will afford a bursary to those who want to go to the vocational skills training programs. And so that is the social safety net that has been provided. Money for bursaries for vocational training, money to be borrowed by those who are coming out of vocational schools to go and set up their small enterprises, and also a provision for training that is coming from SME development, continuously carrying them along to train them on financial inclusiveness and many other facets that are important for them to grow their businesses, their small businesses, medium-scale businesses, into responsible, big, growing, you know, developing businesses that will one day become, they will one day mature to become private sector players of the future. Even the CEO of Barrick was quoted as expressing themselves, commenting that there is now a better investment climate in Zambia that will attract even their rethinking about participating, just like FQM has done. So Barrick too, we count on them that they'll be looking. They will be looking to probably expanding their property in Lumwana, while there will be newcomers that are coming on the block that are Ken that will also cater to those who are who prefer to recruit and to be recruited to get employed in the mining sector again. So we have those investors that are coming in, absorbing some of those who are falling off from those that are adjusting, who are going through some business restructuring at the moment. And we have those that are prepared to go and set it up for themselves while they are being held on two hands by the SME ministry, the science and technology ministry, as well as the local government ministry that is providing the resources through the CDF.
Brenda Tambatamba is Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Analysts or experts say it appears China is considering establishing a second naval base in Africa on the Atlantic coast. They also say due to China's routine denial about its intentions, its credibility in Africa has drawn mixed reaction. This after China on many occasions denied it was establishing a military base in Djibouti. Experts say the yet-to-be-established base will help China project strength and power on the global stage. But the African Union has cautioned its member states not to sign agreements that enable developed nations to establish military bases in their respective countries. Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, recently penned an article about China's speculated plan to establish a second naval base in Africa. I reached him for more on the latest on China's plans.
What my report does is it tries to explain China's thinking in terms of basing scenarios. It provides insight into why China is pursuing expeditionary capabilities. It looks at the record of behavior and the record of practice in terms of indicators that might suggest potential scenarios and options that China might settle for on the African continent. It doesn't exactly state where China is going next, but what it does or what China is going to do, because that is very difficult and frankly, it is impossible. However, it provides a set of indicators that policy analysts, researchers, military scholars and decision makers can use to be able to try and get a better understanding about China's basing doctrine, China's basing practices, and the record of past behavior.
Some say what is wrong with a China decision to establish yet another naval base in Africa, especially when other world powers have military bases in Africa?
I mentioned this in my report, that other countries have got bases, United States, United Kingdom. I mentioned the United Kingdom one because it's a really huge presence in Kenya, and it's a presence that China does not come anywhere close to having that kind of presence in Africa. You cannot even compare the base that China has in Djibouti and the presence the British Army has had in Kenya since independence. Africans have had a very complicated relationship and a very complicated history with foreign intervention. And foreign intervention and the establishment of bases, whether it's done by China or whether it's done by the US or Russia, tends to be frowned upon by Africans. And some of the evidence that can be cited, and which indeed is cited in the report, is the AU decision. The AU has taken a decision, the AU Peace and Security Council took a decision, first of all, expressing concern and warning member countries to be careful about signing agreements that will establish more foreign bases on the continent.
Paul, some people have also questioned China's thought process, because sometimes they shroud what they want to do in some cloud or mystery, or don't really detail what they plan to do until the last minute or when it is done before they know. Does this really undermine what they plan to do in terms of the projection of power or try to make friends on the international stage?
I think it does. So yes, indeed. Anytime any story comes up concerning the potential establishment of a Chinese base, African observers tend to go back to that Djibouti experience, and they tend to argue that, listen, China denied this up until the very last minute, so why should we believe? If China then comes up and says, no, we don't have any plans for instance, to build a base just out of argument's sake in Namibia or Kenya or Tanzania, because these are countries that have been cited in the past, then local actors then say, okay, why should we believe you? Because when it came to Djibouti, we saw exactly what happened. So yes, indeed, it does create credibility problems for China. It does create credibility problems. It does create image problems. But I think it will be important to note that just judging from the growth and the expansion of China's geostrategic footprint on the continent, which is growing day by day, I mean, you already have over 10,000 Chinese firms on the continent. About 2,000-3,000 of them are state-owned enterprises. You have all these high-value investments that are being put in place. You also have a growing number of military-to-military cooperation agreements with different African countries, an expansion of Chinese participation in peacekeeping operations. My guess is that within the next 7 to 15 years, we shouldn't be surprised if China moves ahead and establishes more military facilities on the continent. It should not come as a surprise, judging from the current trajectory of Chinese interest and the expansion of Chinese activities on the continent.
Paul Nantulia is a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Sonny. The Men's Basketball Africa League finals continue on Sunday with two quarterfinal games at the Kigali Arena in Rwanda. Joining us now from Kigali to tell us more is VOA Sonny Young. Spotted greetings, Sonny.
What's the atmosphere been like at the Kigali Arena?
Well, Peter, on Saturday at the Kigali Arena, there was a near-capacity crowd of almost 10,000. I did see a few empty seats. Great atmosphere, Peter. The FAP fans from Cameroon were waving the Cameroon flag. The supporters of Rwanda Energy Group, they had trumpets and drums, singing and dancing. I thought it was a wonderful atmosphere. However, the team from Cameroon, FAP, did prevail by a score of 66-63 and left many of the hometown Rwanda fans very disappointed. In the opening day game on Saturday, Petro de Luanda from Angola, one of the continental powers in African men's basketball, they defeated AS Sale of Morocco by a score of 102-89. Carlos Moraes with a game-high 27 points for Petro de Luanda.
Well, Sonny, this new Basketball Africa League is in its second year of existence. Do you think it will grow in terms of participating teams and host cities?
Peter, just to review a little bit, last year, the Basketball Africa League held its inaugural season, and it was basically a compressed two-week schedule here in Kigali at the same Kigali Arena. And this time around, they changed the format a bit for the second season. The games began in March in Dakar, Senegal, and then they moved to Cairo, Egypt in April. And now they've wound up here in Kigali for the Basketball Africa League finals. So we had three African cities participating in season 2022 of the Basketball Africa League. I think it is possible, Peter, that we will see more African cities hosting games down the road and more African countries for that matter. I know other African countries have expressed interest in hosting the Basketball Africa League games. There are infrastructure questions. Is the arena suitable for hosting games? But yes, I think we're going to see more teams. This time around, the league started with a total of 12 teams. And even one of the teams that's participating on Sunday here in Kigali, the Cape Town Tigers, I've spoken with their coach, Relton Boyson, and He has predicted maybe in a year or two that there could be as many as 20 teams, maybe even more, participating in the Basketball Africa League. So, yes, Peter, I think there is room for future growth.
So, Sonny, what's the impact of the league's partners, talking about the National Basketball Association, the NBA, and FIBA, the International Basketball Federation?
Huge impact, Peter, especially the NBA. I think the NBA really is the driving force for this new Basketball Africa League. The NBA is financing the league. They have even sent some of their organizational people here to Rwanda to help out with media credentialing, hospitality. I think the NBA is definitely, it has a huge impact on the success of this league. I can't underscore enough the financial impact that the NBA is bringing to the Men's Basketball Africa League. And, you know, we even have some ex-NBA players, Peter, participating here in Kigali. Just to name one, Ike Diagu. He'll be playing for Zamalek on Sunday evening here in Kigali. Ike is a veteran player for Nigeria's national men's team, and he began his professional career with a few years in the NBA. So even players like Ike Diagu, Peter, they bring NBA seasoning, NBA expertise to the Men's Basketball Africa League. They can teach these younger players. And I think that's where the BAL really needs to focus. They need to develop the younger players in Africa, both men and women.
That was my colleague VOA Sunny Young reporting from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, families of people kidnapped from a train in Nigeria's Kaduna State 2 months ago are protesting a decision by authorities to resume service on the railway next week. Officials of the Nigerian Railway Corporation, or NRC, said trains will begin running between the capital Abuja and Kaduna City again on Monday. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital Abuja.
Relatives of kidnapped victims met Thursday morning to protest the planned resumption of train service on the Kaduna-Abuja line. Authorities suspended service indefinitely on March 28th, the day armed men blew up tracks in Kaduna and attacked a train. 9 people were killed during the attack and scores are still missing. During Thursday's protest, the spokesperson of the group, Abdul Fatai Jima, said at least 61 people are believed to be held captive, including Jima's wife. He said the government has been insensitive to the family's plight.
Our relatives kidnapped are still in captivity, and we want them to be free first before they can start thinking of that. We want the NRC management and the Minister of Transportation to put adequate security measures in place to guarantee the safety of passengers before train services can resume. These are the minimum conditions we require from them.
Idahat Yusuf's 2 sisters, both in their 50s, are also among the abducted passengers. She does not understand why the NRC would restart train service.
The national pain is not only the family's pain. So why would they choose to move on like that?
The NRC said the decision to resume operations is not a sign of insensitivity to the situation and said efforts continue to release the captives. Security experts say negotiations have been deadlocked since the kidnappers demanded authorities release members of their gang in exchange for the abductees. Jimo says the families have been given few details about the talks.
We have information from some government sources that discussions are ongoing with the abductors. We just don't know the extent or how far they have gone in these negotiations.
The kidnappers have freed only three abductees, including a pregnant woman who told local news organizations that she was freed out of pity. Northern Nigeria has seen a wave of kidnappings for ransom over the past 18 months. This week, police arrested 31 people on charges of abducting students from a school in Kaduna State last year. Authorities also recovered 61 firearms, 376 rounds of ammunition, 22 cartridges, and $5,000 cash. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Morocco's RS Berkane are the champions of the 2021-2022 CAF Confederation Cup. They beat South Africa's Orlando Pirates 5-4 on post-match penalties in the final played at the Goodswill Akapabio Stadium in Uyo, Nigeria. The game was forced into penalties after a 1-1 draw in regulation plus extra time. Pirates forward Thembiko Silok had mixed fortunes as he scored an equalizer in the 117th minute, but his penalty was saved in the shootout. He was the only one who missed on Pirates' side, while Berkane converted all their five kicks. In women football, Nigeria and Ghana moved closer to the India 2022 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup qualification with the final round of first leg victories over Ethiopia and Morocco, respectively, on Friday. Nigeria beat Ethiopia in Addis Ababa, while the Ghanaians defeated Morocco 2-0 in Accra. At Abebe Bikala Stadium, Apayemi Ajakaye broke the deadlock with her 36th-minute strike. With the first leg lead, the Nigerians will seek to complete their qualification bid when they welcome the East Africans for the second leg at the Manshu Dabiola Stadium in Abuja on June 4th. Elsewhere in Accra, the Black Maidens relied on goals from Stella Anyamieke and Nancy Amor to secure a comfortable lead over the Moroccans at the Accra Sports Stadium. The second leg showdown with the North Africans will be at the Prince Mole Al Hassan Stadium in Rabat, also on June 4th. Meanwhile, three women referees and three women assistant referees were announced on Thursday by FIFA among 129 officials selected for World Cup duty. These women referees will make World Cup history by officiating games at a major men's tournament for the first time in Qatar. According to FIFA, among those announced are Rwanda's Samila Mukansanga and Japanese official Yoshimi Hamashita. The tournament will be played from November 21st to December 18th. And on Thursday, June 16th, FIFA will make major and highly anticipated announcement related to the staging of the FIFA World Cup 2026 across Canada, Mexico, and the United States. 22 candidates host cities are currently vying for the right to stage matches for the 48-team tournament hosted by three nations, and this will be the first time three nations would host the FIFA World Cup. And the 2022 Basket Africa League playoffs and finals began at Kigali Arena in Rwanda on Saturday. They ran until May 28th. The top eight teams from the league's Sahara and Nile conferences are competing in a single elimination playoffs and finals, with the winner crowned the second Basketball Africa League champion. On Saturday, Petro de Rwanda and FAP won their games on day one of the quarterfinals. Petro de Rwanda defeated SL 102-89, while FAP beat Rwanda Energy Group REP 66-63. The winners of the quarterfinal matchups will meet in the semifinals on May 25th for the chance to advance to the 2022 BAL Finals, which will be held on May 28th. And that's it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. More often than not, when matters pertaining to United Nations peacekeeping are discussed, there is always the emphasis that the major peacekeeping UN forces in Africa are very important and therefore useful to the stability of the continent. Also, with relations to that matter, it's always stressed that the cost of the operations on the continent amounts to billions of US dollars. In fact, there are African citizens who are living in countries where United Nations peacekeeping forces are deployed, who lament the fact that the enormous amount spent on UN peacekeeping in the country should have been used to alleviate poverty, which they consider as one of the underlying causes of conflict. Nevertheless, Africans should be gratified that the UN has played a useful role in the continent. The first peacekeeping force on the Suez Canal and Sinai, 1956 to 1967, and the next in 1973 to 79, played a useful role in averting serious international crisis. So too was the UN role in the Congo, called ONUC, from 1960 to 1964, which helped to keep the Congo united despite the efforts of Moise Tshombe to divide the Congo by declaring the independence of Katanga. We must, of course, remember that that operation created a bitter taste for African leaders because a major prime minister and nationalist, Lumumba, was killed during the operation of ONUC. The UN also played a useful peaceful role in both Liberia and Sierra Leone, although no one should ignore or forget that the fundamental foundation for the stability of those two countries was laid by ECOMOG, ECOWAS peacekeeping machinery. Also, we found out that the UN played a useful role in Namibia for its independence, in South Africa through the transitions from apartheid to black majority rule, to Somalia during the chaotic period after the fall of Said Barre, and in, of course, Rwanda, even though that oppression has left a stain in UN peacekeeping in Africa. But the concern now is what is happening to current United Nations peacekeeping forces on the continent. In Mali, things look so chaotic. What is the real role of a UN peacekeeping force at a time when France, the leading force in that peacekeeping, is leaving because of the request of the government, and those European countries that have been helping to defeat the terrorists in the Sahel are also leaving? And then we have the Wagner group in also Mali. So what really is the real role of UN peacekeeping in Mali? We have a similar problem in the Central Africa. There too, no one can tell really what is going on. You also have the Wagner group in Central Africa. People have doubts about it. But more worrying is the UN peacekeeping force in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. This has been there for years, even decades, and yet problems remain. During the time of President Kabila, efforts were made to withdraw the oppression from the Congo. However, since the reform of peacekeeping in October 1963, it is no longer the call of the host government for the withdrawal of peacekeeping. That should be left only to the Security Council. UN peacekeeping also played a very important role in dealing with elections. For example, it was in Eritrea. Now, when you also look at southern South Sudan, the UN force has played a role, but you are hearing something which we have heard so often in the Congo. In Ituri province of eastern Congo, you have rebel forces killing each other. Civilians are being killed in large numbers, although they have not yet hit the international media. Particularly, children are being killed in Ituri province. They are fighting for the mining of gold. And yet, you don't hear about the role of the UN peacekeeping to stop this killing. A few months ago, the forces of Uganda, with the agreement of the president of Congo, came in to help in eastern Congo to stop all of this killing. But that force is now withdrawing. The president of Rwanda has also volunteered to send troops to eastern Congo to maintain stability. But that has not yet come to fruition. But the real question is, what is the role of the United Nations peacekeeping force in the Congo after decades of presence in that country? Just last week, an official of South Sudan government raised this same issue of what is the effect of UN peacekeeping. The official noted that his government has taken a decision to enter Abyei, a territory that has caused a lot of problems in the past in negotiations. There is no agreement between the Sudan and South Sudan as to who owns that territory. The matter should have been resolved by a referendum. But since there has not been any agreement as to who should participate, Abyei remains a contested territory. What will happen if South Sudan send troops into this territory? This may light a flash and cause problems. So why is the role of the UN? Because according to the South Sudanese, UN peacekeeping has not been playing its proper role. In the circumstances, it may be useful for the Secretary General of the United Nations to designate either one of its senior staff or an outside consultant who knows about peacekeeping to take a look at all these peacekeeping forces now going on in Africa to determine how best to make them effective and useful. Unless this is done, we may have a situation where Africans begin to look at UN peacekeeping in the way our founding fathers ended up looking at ONUC, the operation in the Congo, 1960-1964. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Wake up, call out your money, call out your money. Wake up, Tera, 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 go get the mula. Wake up, oh, Koniko Kala, Kala Koya, Kala Koya, don't walk, you don't drive, drive. Supposed to be die, die. Kill him, come, he come, best in my town, best in with a man. But when I land softly on the sofa floor. So far, so good, Koni Bajo, let me see you. Oh, lo, 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 let me see you. Oh, lo, 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 Bukao, let me, Bukao, let me see you, de Buka. Oh, lo, 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 let me see you. Oh, lo, lo, lo.
Choosing, choosing, choosing.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, leave the truth that can ruin a marriage unsaid. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Ukraine ruled out a ceasefire or any territorial concessions to Moscow, while Russia intensified its attack in the eastern Donbas region and stopped sending gas to Finland in its latest response to Western sanctions and its deepening international isolation. Polish President Andrzej Duda told Ukraine's parliament that ceding even 1 inch of the country's territory would be a blow to the whole West and reassured Kyiv of Warsaw's strong backing for its European Union. He's the first foreign leader to address Ukrainian lawmakers in person since the February 24th invasion. Ukraine's president has said that the Donbas region remains sovereign to Ukraine. Here's AP's Karen Chamas.
Speaking at a joint news conference with Portuguese President Antonio Costa, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said, however, that Ukraine would not launch a counterattack into Russian territory. Everyone is afraid that Ukraine will somehow attack the Russian Federation. I want to remind everyone that we are waging war on our own territory. Zelensky also said his forces were fighting to defend their land. This is our territory, and we're going step by step, and we'll go further to liberate our territory. He pressed Western countries for multiple launch rocket systems, which he said just stand still in other countries, yet are key to Ukraine's success. I'm Karen Chamas.
A bid by Ukraine to join the European Union would not be finalized for 15 or 20 years, France's Europe minister said Sunday, pouring cold water for quick entry in the wake of Russia's invasion. He said he didn't want to offer, quote, Ukrainians any illusions or lies, end quote, reiterating an offer by President Emmanuel Macron to create a looser European political community that could help integrate Ukraine with the bloc sooner. This is VOA News. Australia's centre-left opposition party has toppled the ruling Conservative Party after almost a decade in power.
I am humbled by this victory, and I'm honoured to be given the opportunity to serve as the 31st Prime Minister of Australia.
These are the words of new Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. His victory speech also included promises of sharper reductions in greenhouse gas emissions while he faces an early foreign policy test. Outgoing Prime Minister Scott Morrison said he accepted the will of the Australian people.
I've always believed in Australians and their judgment, and I've always been prepared to accept their verdicts. And tonight they have delivered their verdict, and I congratulate Anthony Albanese and the Labor Party, and I wish him and his government all the very best.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Sunday called Australia's incoming prime minister to congratulate him on his election victory and underline the strength of their country's alliance, the White House said. The two leaders will meet Tuesday at the Quad Group Summit in Tokyo, and the White House has praised Albanese for deciding to make the trip. President Biden made his first public comments on the monkeypox disease after being asked about it during his visit to South Korea. He said cases in the U.S. and Europe are concerning.
It's something that everybody should be concerned about. We're working on it hard to figure out what we do and what vaccine, if any, may be available for. But it is a concern in the sense that if it were to spread, it's consequential.
Most people recover from monkeypox without hospitalization, but it can be fatal. Britain is seeing daily infections of the rare monkeypox virus that are unconnected to any travel to West Africa, where the disease is endemic, a health official said Sunday. The UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, said new figures would be released Monday after it registered 20 cases Friday. Asked if community transmission was now the norm in Britain, the UKHSA chief medical advisor said, absolutely. India must establish rules on cryptocurrencies to resolve regulatory uncertainty, protect investors, and boost its crypto sector. That according to CoinSwitch CEO Ashish Singhal Sunday. Singhal is a former Amazon engineer who co-founded CoinSwitch, attending the World Economic Forum in Davos. Recapping our top story, of course, what's happening in Ukraine. It ruled out a ceasefire or any territorial concessions to Moscow, while Russia intensified its attack in the eastern Donbas region and stopped sending gas to Finland in its latest response to Western sanctions and its deepening international isolation. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA executive producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Welcome, Steve, and welcome, Kane. This is your first time joining us on the show.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, here are the issues. The political sway of former U.S. President Donald Trump over Republican Party politics was tested again in the most dramatic night so far in this election cycle as his preferred candidates faced off with Republican opponents in party primaries in key states. President Joe Biden declared that last weekend's mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, in which a white teenage gunman allegedly killed 10 black people at a grocery store in a racist rampage, was domestic terrorism. Biden briefly revived a long-running appeal for federal gun legislation, including a ban on assault weapons. However, Republicans oppose additional federal gun restrictions, and Democrats need at least 10 Republicans to vote with them in the Senate to overcome any legislative filibuster to pass most legislation. The EU's efforts to impose a new round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine appears to be tougher than expected, as a small group of countries continue to oppose a ban on Russian oil imports. Finland and Sweden have officially applied for membership in the NATO military alliance. Here in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, says the number of counties considered to be at high risk of spreading COVID has almost tripled in the last 2 weeks. A new Gallup survey suggests many Americans are no longer wearing masks and social distancing, sparking concerns that ignoring health protocols will prolong the pandemic. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, high-profile battles were fought in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, while voters in Idaho, Kentucky, and Oregon also went to the polls. How will these primaries shape the Republican and Democratic parties as we look ahead to the midterms?
All of the primaries are being watched for two things. One, how strong a grip does former President Donald Trump have on the Republican Party? He has endorsed candidates across the board in many, not just at the very top of the ballots, but many down ballot and in many statewide only elections, he's endorsed some candidates. So we're watching that. And we're also watching on the Democratic side, which part of the Democratic Party is going to be stronger in this election cycle, the progressive side or the more moderate side. And we're seeing in many of these primary elections that on the Republican side, Trump still has a hold on the party. And on the Democratic side, the progressives are making some gains against the moderates. So that's what we're seeing so far and what we're looking at so far.
Yeah, former President Donald Trump wants to make this midterm election race and the primary races that lead up to that a referendum on him. And I think with maybe a couple of notable exceptions, he's proving that he does have influence on the Republican base and on the voters who are turning out for these primary elections, with the exception of a congressional race in North Carolina, that's Madison Cawthorn, and then also the Idaho governor's race. The lieutenant governor in Idaho was a Trump-backed candidate, and she was defeated in the primary race there. But other than that, I think many of the candidates that Donald Trump has publicly endorsed have been successful in reaching those Republican-based voters who vote in those primary elections.
One of the things, though, in many of those victories, not all of them, but many of them, especially the ones where there are multiple candidates in the race. Let's take a look at Pennsylvania, for instance. In Pennsylvania, we have a television doctor, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is slightly ahead of former hedge fund CEO David McCormick, both of whom are Republicans, both of whom appealed to Donald Trump for his endorsement, asked Trump to give his endorsement. And there was another candidate who also parroted a lot of former President Trump's lines about elections and fraud in elections and appeared to be very, very conservative. So there was basically a three-way race in Pennsylvania. Dr. Oz got Trump's endorsement about a month or so ago, and so far he's got a very slight lead over McCormick. And the third candidate, Kathy Barnett, is also running strong. So there's almost a three-way split in the votes. And if you look at other races so far this primary season, Trump-backed candidates in a multiple, if it's more than one candidate, are only getting about 30 to 33% of the Republican vote in these primaries. While Trump-backed candidates are maybe winning, they're not necessarily getting a majority of the votes among Republicans. So that's something that we want to watch through the rest of the primary season.
Also, too, the claims of election fraud continue in these primary races, unfounded claims, illegitimate claims of election fraud from the 2020 presidential election. And this three-way race that Steve has mentioned in Pennsylvania right now is so close that it could, in fact, trigger a recount in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's election code requires the Secretary of State to order all county boards of their elections to conduct a recount if the leading candidate isn't ahead by 0.5%. And that's how close it is in those races there. So what's going to wind up happening if the results when they're tallied don't give a candidate a lead of more than 0.5%, there's going to have to be a recount. And I think that's only going to fuel these unfounded and inaccurate claims of election fraud. And some of that's already starting to bleed into the results as they're being tallied here over the last couple of days.
And when you look at races such as the one in Pennsylvania, where it is very, very close, what is that really saying about voters? What are voters looking for in these candidates?
Well, we have to remember that typically in these primary races, it's the party faithful that turn out to vote. You know, this is not an election that's indicative of, say, a presidential election when, you know, the general population, the most amount of voters turn out to vote. So these are highly motivated, in many cases, political partisans who want to make sure that their candidate is the one who is represented heading into a general midterm election for the Senate and congressional races that are up this year. It's reflective of the party base, the voters of that party, but it is not necessarily reflective of the general electorate in those areas, such as those states or those congressional districts. So, you know, turnout in these elections won't be as high as they might be in the general election for these midterm elections in November, and certainly not like they would be in a presidential election.
One of the things that we're noticing is those people who are, quote, never Trumpers, who oppose Donald Trump within the Republican Party, are losing. They are not winning their races for the most part in these three-way matches or these multiple candidate matches. What it's showing is kind of the fissures that there are within the Republican Party between those who support Donald Trump and those who want to move on from Donald Trump.
Another thing to remember here also is that, you know, there is some analysis that shows that we have become more polarized as an electorate, and even so within a party base. So Steve just mentioned never Trumpers, and that would be a faction of the Republican Party that simply will never vote for Donald Trump or accept Donald Trump's brand of politics, which also is sometimes referred to as Trumpism. But there is some indication, especially in the results of the 2020 presidential election, that there are many of those people who might describe themselves as a never Trumper that have moved to the Democratic Party. These people, they might have voted Republican in the past, but were turned off by Donald Trump. Well, they're not voting in these Republican primaries now. They could either be voting as a Democrat in the Democratic primaries, or they're independents who might just be waiting to see how these primaries shape up, and they will vote in the midterm election and then obviously in the general election. It's also notable to point out, and Steve, you'll have to help me out with the numbers here. I mean, I think Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election actually won the popular vote by more than 8 million votes. Am I right with that?
Close, yes.
And there was over 150 million votes cast, right?
Yes.
When we look at those massive numbers in a presidential election, these numbers, when we're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands of voters in each state or each congressional district turning out to vote, is not necessarily representative of how, say, maybe the next presidential election is going to shape up. But another thing that's also notable that I wanted to add, we talk about Donald Trump's influence on the Republican Party an awful lot. It's interesting because he's making news by endorsing candidates. But what we don't notice is news made by Joe Biden endorsing candidates on the Democratic side. I guess it remains to be seen whether or not Joe Biden's endorsement would either help or hurt a candidate as they're heading into the midterm elections, but certainly not covered in the news, or it doesn't make for television Joe Biden making an endorsement announcement or showing up to campaign for that person as Donald Trump does.
Yes, and also we have in Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman winning the Democratic Senate primary. So what does this win mean for progressive Democrats?
It's an important win for progressive Democrats. Fetterman was aligned with Bernie Sanders in the 2020 election. Sanders was Biden's chief competition and is a very progressive, self-described socialist. But Fetterman has got a popularity part of his appeal. He's a giant man. He's about 6'8", very imposing, tattooed and shaved head, and comes across as very much of a populist, almost in a way that Donald Trump did during the 2016 election campaign. He is going to be a very formidable candidate against whichever of the Republicans win. One other thing that I want to note about Pennsylvania is that there's a Republican candidate for governor, a guy named Doug Mastriano, who is a state senator. He is an unabashed believer in Trump's false narrative that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. A few days before the primary election, Trump endorsed him once he saw he was likely to win. The importance here is that whoever is elected governor will have a say in how the 2024 election, presidential election, turns out. And Democrats are so sure that this guy, Doug Mastriano, is a damaged candidate that they took out TV ads in order to prop him up for the primary for him to win. They believe that they can defeat him for governor.
I want to dovetail on something that Stephen said about Fetterman's candidacy. So in the interest of fullest possible disclosure, I'm originally from Pittsburgh, and that is the area that Fetterman is from. And he represents a very strong working class background. You know, he comes from a family that lived in an area where the steel mills were the primary employer of the people, the working class people who lived in the area. In 2016, Donald Trump appealed to voters in what we now call the Rust Belt, which is the industrial part of America that many people who lived there feel is forgotten. They were the workforce of America, the people who went to the steel mills and to the manufacturing plants to work, which have seen job losses, erosion of their workforce, erosion of union protections and union strength. And so Donald Trump appealed to those voters. He was the person who said, I alone can fix your woes, and I can help you get your jobs back, and I can help re-empower America. Fetterman, in this case, is that candidate. He is the candidate who can represent more of that idea to voters in the state of Pennsylvania. And he is not a Republican. He is a Democrat. If, in fact, Dr. Oz is the person who winds up winning the Republican primary, it'll be an interesting dynamic to see how all of these messages wind up shaping the race for the Senate seat in Pennsylvania and how much that's going to influence voter turnout.
Yes, it's really good analysis that you both did on these primaries that have been taking place. But want to move on now to our next topic. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden traveled to Buffalo, New York, to mourn with the relatives of those killed by a gunman who allegedly drove 200 miles to the grocery store where he shot and killed 10 people. Biden called for U.S. citizens to unite against white supremacy. While many people lose their lives every day due to senseless murders, should U.S. citizens be more concerned about the shootings that are fueled by racism?
I guess I'm just going to be honest here and explain that I have covered too many of these myself as a correspondent for Voice of America. I covered a shooting here in Illinois. I covered the shooting of the Sikh community in Wisconsin. We continue to have these issues. And when another one of these incidents happens, it's like history repeating itself, and there doesn't seem to be meaningful solutions that address the root causes of these shootings. Yes, we should all be concerned. We should be more concerned. Americans should be more engaged and active in trying to prevent these things from happening in their communities. And it isn't really, you know, up to one segment, one community, one race, one gender. I mean, this is an effort that requires unification on the part of Americans to address it. There also needs to be a way to stop the radicalization of the people who engage in these activities online. If there was a clear answer to how to fix these problems, somebody would have stepped forward and done it already. But something has to be done. Somebody has to have the answer. Somebody has to come forward with meaningful action and meaningful solutions that can help not only prevent it, but you have to repair some of the damage that's been done between these communities. It's not just a matter of preventing it the next time. There has to be a tremendous amount of effort to help the country heal.
Unfortunately, this kind of gun violence has become just another part of American life. Most Americans do not own a gun. Fewer than 50% of Americans have a gun in their household. According to the latest Gallup poll, 52% of Americans favor stricter gun laws. 4 years ago, in 2018, 67% of Americans favored stricter gun laws. Now it's 52%. I don't have a really good explanation as to why that number has dropped so precipitously in just 4 years.
Well, also to Steve, to your point, that number has dropped while the influence of the major gun lobby in America, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, has effectively been weakened in that time. They are not as strong as they used to be. I think they were on the verge of declaring bankruptcy. They've become almost an impotent lobbying organization while they've had to sort out their financial woes. So that number has decreased while the influence of the chief lobbyist for the group has also waned.
Yet despite the decrease in the National Rifle Association's power, there still isn't enough political will in Congress to toughen the gun laws. As you mentioned, Kim, in the open, Democrats who want to strengthen the gun laws need 10 Republican senators to come over to their side in order to just get a vote on stricter gun laws. So it doesn't appear that Congress is going to act anytime soon. The shooting in Buffalo happened in a state that has one of the most strict gun laws in the country, and yet this stuff keeps happening. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that.
And I also think there is some indication that this shooter in Buffalo had signaled what was going to happen online prior to it occurring. There was also some troubling signals that he was exhibiting with his behavior in school and leading up to the shooting. The question now is, were some of the concerns about his behavior and his intentions dismissed prior to this tragedy? Is there more that can be done to monitor this kind of behavior and maybe have an intervention before things like this occur? I think that's a part of the discussion now that's being framed in the wake of this tragedy.
And it's a discussion that is difficult to have because mental health is not just here in America, but worldwide, is an issue that is difficult to tackle. Because of American culture, it is difficult to intervene in someone else's issues.
That is so true, and we'll have to end the discussion on that topic for the sake of time. And it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, why the newest round of sanctions on Russia may be tough to pull off. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest Correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Well, in our next topic, the EU's efforts to impose a new round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine appears to be tougher than expected as a small group of countries continue to oppose a ban on Russian oil imports. For instance, Hungary is one landlocked EU country that is highly dependent on Russian oil, along with the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Bulgaria has also reservations. So how is the EU going to get around these hurdles, especially with Russia continuing to make money from these countries?
That's a really good question, how the European Union is going to try and deal with this, because so much of its energy comes from Russia. One third of the European Union's consumption of natural gas comes from Russia. One fourth of the European Union's oil imports come from Russia. The United States, before all of this began in Ukraine, had been trying to get the Middle East and the Gulf region, Emirates and countries, to help backfill any needs that the Europeans might have. That said, getting them off of Russian gas, which is easy to transport to the European Union, getting them off of Russian gas and oil is going to be an even longer process. And now that the Ukrainians seem to be at least holding the Russians to a stalemate, if not winning the battle on the field, it may be a little bit longer before the European Union, especially those countries that you mentioned, give in to a Russian oil embargo.
I think right now what the plan is, at least on the part of the European Union, is you can't turn off the tap instantly and all at one time. It looks like the European Union is gravitating towards a sort of phased or oil embargo in which it tries to gradually shrink Russia's energy income. I guess what the European Union is hoping to do by doing this, it's going to be phased pain, so to speak, in trying to figure out how to deal with the loss of those imports. It won't all happen at one time. there could perhaps be an effort to find different sources of production for that. That's the difficulty, though. I mean, right now, when you have an established route and you have established means to get it there, it's not just easy to turn off the tap and redirect the supply from somewhere else.
Finland and Sweden have officially applied for membership in the NATO military alliance. So what will these two countries bring to the table?
The seismic change in the makeup of NATO. Finland and Sweden have been neutral throughout the Cold War, effectively, and joining NATO from Russia's northern border almost to its southern border with Europe. It will primarily contain NATO countries, with the exception now of Belarus and Ukraine and Georgia. This is exactly what Vladimir Putin did not want to have happen, you know, at least publicly that he stated is why he was invading Ukraine. And so now to have this happen, it definitely changes the order in Europe, I guess, to protect Europe from future aggression by the Russians.
Especially in Finland, which adds another 1,300 kilometers of border that Russia now has with NATO. And Finland fought a war against Russia back in the late 1930s and ceded some land to the Soviet Union in order to end the war. They see that possibility that Russia will look at Finland much the same way it looked at Ukraine, that Russia used to have parts of Finland, and Finland, I think, was really spooked by the attack on Ukraine and believed that it was vulnerable. I see this as a big gain for NATO and yet more losses for Russia.
For both Sweden and Finland, this decision to join NATO happened at striking speed. There's been very little public discourse about it or general debate about their membership in it. It happened very quickly, and it's moving now in a process that's also moving along very quickly. It just shows how concerned these countries are about their security.
Absolutely. And I wanted to get our last topic in. Health officials report a spike in the new Omicron subvariant of COVID cases here in the U.S. So I just wanted to quickly get your thoughts on this new spread of COVID. The people I've talked to, it's a personal decision on whether they are wearing a mask or not, or to practice social distancing.
Here in the Midwest of the United States, and particularly in the state of Illinois where I live, we've had some of the most strict mask mandates and COVID protections put in place in the previous 2 years. It was about 2 or 3 months ago that the mask mandate here in the state of Illinois was lifted. I can tell you just by where I live, the general feeling among the population here is that it is a personal choice. I think there's a lot of people who are just unwilling to be forced to wear a mask or to curb their activities or to prevent from large public gatherings. And I think the mentality here has shifted from one of protection to one of management, meaning that if you're concerned about contracting COVID, the personal decision you have to make is whether or not you engage in public activities or put yourself in a crowd or put yourself into a position where you could possibly be infected. Again, too, they've just announced that there is a booster. The FDA has approved a booster for children ages 5 to 11. You know, that could help increase protection or at least increase the prevention of spread.
And after 2+ years of the COVID pandemic, many Americans are ready to declare it over. Unlikely we'll see mask mandates return anytime soon. I think the biggest number to watch right now is hospitalizations. It's at its lowest level since last August, but it's ticking up. And watching hospitalizations is going to be the real key to whether or not any other government mandates come down over the next month, 3 months, 6 months.
And we're going to have to close the show on that note. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish and VOA Midwest Correspondent Kane Farabaugh. Thank you both so much for your insights and analysis on these challenging issues. I'm Kim Lewis, and on a programming note, we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening to Issues in the News.
VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. In 1931, a Belgian cosmologist and Catholic priest named Georges Lemaître published a paper that proposed the beginning and subsequent rapid expansion of what is called the observable universe. It theoretically began with the cataclysmal explosion of a single atomic particle at a single point in time. Scientists have calculated that the universe began some 13.8 billion years ago. The groundwork for this hypothesis was laid in 1915 when Albert Einstein published his theory of general relativity. This premise has become popularly known as the Big Bang Theory. It was facetiously given that name by the English astronomer and astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle during a radio lecture. The thing is, Sir Fred Hoyle never accepted the theory as the origin of the universe. The Big Bang Theory within the scientific community is now considered the predominant model for explaining the beginning of the universe and all it contains. Edwin Hubble, the scientist for whom a NASA space telescope is named, published Hubble's Law, also called Hubble-Lemaître Law, which proposes that the universe continues to expand. In recent years, scientists have won Nobel Prizes for their work in calculating the velocity of this expansion. Over the years, since the theory was first proposed, scientists and lay people alike often question what happened before the Big Bang even took place. Some cosmologists, like today's guest, still have many questions about the original concept of the Big Bang theory, including what occurred fractions of a second before the explosive birth of the universe. My guest for today's show is William Will Kinney. He is a professor of physics at the University at Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences in Buffalo, New York. Professor Kinney is also the author of a newly released book that explores the origins of the cosmos called An Infinity of Worlds, Cosmic Inflation and the Beginning of the Universe. Will, did the universe have an actual start date?
Yes. This is one of the sort of most profound results of cosmology in the 20th century, is the realization that the universe had a beginning. And in the 21st century now, with the advent of modern precision cosmology, lots of this exciting new science that the community is doing, we've actually managed to measure the age of the universe, our universe anyway, really accurately. So we know that the universe began in a very hot, very dense initial state about 13.8 billion years ago. And the sort of measurement uncertainty in that is about 200 million years. So we're measuring it to the age of the universe to within a few percent.
So how is that determined? How is the age of the universe determined?
Well, simply put, the way we measure the age of the universe is by measuring how fast it's expanding. Right. So we can measure when we look out at galaxies in the distant universe, we notice that they're all moving away from us, and they're all moving away from us with a velocity that's proportional to their distance. So the further away something is, the faster it's moving away. So that expansion rate tells us how fast the universe is getting bigger. And if we know what the universe is made of, and we have determined this, at least in a general sense, that the universe is made up of normal stuff like hydrogen and helium, some mysterious stuff called dark matter that we don't really understand, but we can detect it indirectly, and some even weirder stuff called dark energy. If you put that whole cosmic cocktail together, along with the expansion rate that we measure, you can figure out exactly how old the universe was. You can run the clock backward and determine this initial age of the cosmos.
From what I understand, from what I remember, that 80% of all matter in the universe is dark energy.
About 70 to 75, yes.
In your new book, An Infinity of Worlds, you propose that before what we call the Big Bang took place, the universe underwent a cosmic expansion and doubled in size at least 80 times in a fraction of a second. Are you saying that the Big Bang itself didn't birth the universe, but the universe started growing before the explosive event took place? Could you explain that?
Well, in a way, the theory of cosmic inflation is a theory of what happened before the Big Bang. So that moment of the Big Bang, this hot, dense initial state of the universe, happened 13.8 billion years ago. But the question is, where did that come from? What set the initial conditions for the universe? And those initial conditions are very specific. The universe has to be really smooth. It has to be really big. It has to be really close to geometrically flat. Sort of the way that when you look at the Earth, the Earth locally looks flat to you because we're so much smaller than the planet. The universe as a whole looks flat to us as well. And none of these things are explained by sort of the standard Big Bang cosmology. Inflation is a theory that rectifies these deficiencies and creates a, it's a theory for what really happened before this moment, 13.8 billion years ago, where our universe came into existence.
And you were talking about expansion of the universe as far as measuring when the Big Bang took place. And as I'm sure you know, famed scientist Edwin Hubble proposed that the universe continues to expand. And others since then have said that the universe is expanding at a rapid rate. And some scientists have also calculated how fast the universe is expanding. Can you talk about this concept, how it was determined, how we know it's taking place at such a rapid rate, and how are scientists able to actually calculate the rate of expansion?
The way you calculate the rate of expansion is straightforward in principle. It's complicated in practice. And so what you need to do is you need to be able to look out at a distant galaxy, or preferably a whole lot of them, and first of all, measure how far away that thing is. And that's the hard part, because measuring distances to things in astronomy is really difficult. You can't stretch a ruler out. You have to use indirect methods. And so you measure how far, if you can measure how far away, say, a distant galaxy is, and then measure how fast it's moving away from us, that gives you a measure of the rate of the expansion of the universe. So the hard part is measuring how far away things are. And in particular, these measurements that have shown that the expansion of the universe is not slowing down as one might have expected, but is actually speeding up. We typically use very, very bright supernovae. So these are exploding stars that are so bright that you can see them most of the way across the observable universe at a distance of billions or tens of billions of light years. And these are what are called standard candles. They're objects whose brightness you know. So if you look at how bright it appears to be, you can infer the distance to that thing. It's sort of like if you have a 100-watt light bulb, and you look at how bright, you can tell how far away that 100-watt light bulb is by how bright it appears to be to your eye at a distance. This is the idea of a standard candle, and we can do the same thing with supernovae, which are, of course, a whole lot brighter than 100-watt light bulbs.
I'm trying to wrap my head around what you describe as cosmic expansion. I mean, we're all taught that the universe began with the Big Bang, this sudden explosion out of nowhere. And again, a lot of people think, you know, what did happen before the Big Bang took place? Can you tell us a little bit more about what precipitated the Big Bang?
A common misconception, I think, that people have about the Big Bang is that it was like an explosion. Right? That you had some sort of primordial seed that blew up and threw things off in every direction. And the reality is nothing like that. In fact, a better way to think of the Big Bang is that it's a boundary in time, not a point in space. And at that boundary in time, this 13.8 billion years ago, an infinitely large universe sprang into existence all at once. The Big Bang happened everywhere in an infinitely large space at the same time. This is a little hard to get your head around, I know. And the question is, what set those initial conditions? Why did this huge infinite space pop into existence at all? And this is where inflation comes in. So the idea of cosmic inflation is that before this hot, dense initial state of this infinite universe coming into existence, there was a period of expansion. So the universe was also expanding before this, but it was of a very different character. For one thing, instead of being hot and dense, it was cold and empty, and it was filled with nothing except the energy of empty space itself. And that energy of empty space drove an expansion so rapid that everything we see, our entire observable universe, which is everything we see and everything we ever will be able to see, stretched from about the size of a grapefruit to the size of the universe today in a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. So it's truly amazingly rapid expansion of this tiny initial state into the large universe that we happen to live in.
Will, you talk about something called cosmic horizons in your book. Can you give us an easy to understand overview of what this is?
Well, just like on the surface of the Earth, if you look out, you can only see a certain distance because the Earth's surface curves away from you. So you see yourself being at the center of a circular horizon. Similarly, in the cosmos, there's a horizon. That is, we see ourselves at the center of a sphere because it's a three-dimensional object. But the idea of the cosmic horizon is that because the universe has a finite age, and because light travels at a finite speed, you can't see out forever because light has to have time to get to you from these distant places. So although the universe is presumably infinite, although or at least certainly much, much larger than the patch of it that we can see, our local, what we call the observable universe or a horizon, is just how far out you can see within the age of the universe. So for example, if the universe is 14 billion years old, you can only see out about 14 billion light years, the distance that light would travel in that amount of time. And anything further away from that, light hasn't had time to get from there to us in the age of the universe.
Well, you're talking about the observable universe. And I know the Hubble has observed stars that come very close to within a couple hundred million years of the Big Bang. So is it possible, perhaps with the brand new Webb telescope, that would be able to see beyond that, in that, you know, the Big Bang will be recalculated?
Absolutely. So The thing to understand about telescopes is that telescopes really are time machines. Because light travels at a finite speed, when we look out in space, we're also looking back in time. And we think of light as traveling so fast that it's almost instantaneous. We really don't worry about the speed of light in our normal everyday lives. But light actually travels at a really slow pace. So the way I like to put it is that the speed of light is about 30 centimeters per billionth of a second, or about a foot. So a billionth of a second is about how long it takes your cell phone to do one calculation in the chip. And in that amount of time, light only travels about 30 centimeters. And so that when we look out in space, we're looking back in time. When we look at the sun, we see the sun not as it is right this second, but as it was 8 minutes ago, because it takes the light 8 minutes to get to us. When we look out at the nearest large galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, it takes light 2.5 million years to get to us from there. And so we see it as it was 2.5 million years ago. The Hubble telescope, the most distant objects that Hubble can see, were emitted, the light was given off by those objects when the universe was only about 750 million years old, between 5 and 700 million years. And so that light has been traveling to us all this time and is just now reaching us. The new telescopes, in particular the James Webb, will actually be able to see out further still and further back in time. This is really great because an archaeologist, for example, has to reconstruct the past from indirect evidence, from relics. You dig up bones and you figure out what the animals must have looked like, for example. We cosmologists have it relatively easy, is that we don't have to speculate on what the past looked like. We can actually see it. So if you build a telescope that can see out 10 billion light years, you see the universe as it was 10 billion years ago. So the entire history of the cosmos from the Big Bang to today is spread out in front of us. And the further out we look with our telescopes, the further back in time we see, and the earlier and earlier in the history of the universe that we see. So the Webb telescope, for example, will be able to see far enough back in time that it will actually see the formation of the first galaxies in the universe. It won't quite see far out enough to see the formation of the first stars in the universe, when what are called the dark ages ended and the first stars formed and lit the universe up with light. But it will see the immediate aftermath of that. And that's a very exciting prospect.
Let's take a break. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download at our new website, voaafrica.com. You can also find our show on Apple Podcasts and other podcast websites. We hope you'll connect with us on Facebook at VOA Current Affairs, or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. You can also send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today we're discussing the mysterious origins of the universe and all it contains. My guest is William Will Kinney, a professor of physics at the University of Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences in Buffalo, New York. Professor Kinney is also the author of a newly released book that explores the origins of the universe called An Infinity of Worlds, Cosmic Inflation, and the Beginning of the Universe. Well, when discussing topics like cosmology, I think it's difficult not to mention the contributions made by the late, great Albert Einstein.
Einstein's theory of gravity, which is called general relativity, is really the GOAT, right? It's the greatest of all time. It has withstood tremendous efforts to falsify it, if you like, so that every time we try to measure something, every time we test Einstein's theory of gravity, it comes out exactly right. That's a really beautiful thing.
One of the things that he tried to reconcile, from what I'm remembering, is the idea of quantum physics with the general theory of relativity. Can you tell us about any role that quantum physics may have played in the creation of the universe?
Well, the unification of gravity and quantum mechanics is one of the foremost outstanding problems in theoretical physics currently. They don't play nicely with each other. They're not, as far as we know, they're not compatible. And coming up with a larger theory that incorporates both of them is something that we still have yet to do. However, getting back to the theory of inflation in particular, this theory of what happened before the Big Bang, quantum mechanics is really essential. Because one of the other things that the standard Big Bang cosmology doesn't explain is where structure in the universe came from. The universe we see today is full of galaxies and planets and stars and people and all of these things, that the universe is clumpy and has all of this very complex structure in it on scales heading out toward hundreds of millions of light years. What we do know about this structure was that it was created by gravity acting on tiny little perturbations in the early universe. So the early universe was almost completely smooth, and it had little regions that were a little bit more dense than their surroundings, and regions that were a little bit less dense, these little fluctuations in the density of the universe that were about one part in 100,000. And we can measure these in various ways. But what the standard cosmology doesn't tell you is where those initial seeds for structure in the universe came from. The theory of inflation answers this with quantum mechanics. In inflation, this is actually a quantum mechanical process that happens in this extraordinarily rapid expansion that happens before the onset of the hot Big Bang. Tiny little quantum fluctuations in the vacuum of space are stretched out to enormous scales. And these echoes that are left behind in the curvature of the space-time itself form the seeds of cosmic structure that forms into everything we see in our universe later. So it's a very elegant unification of gravity and quantum physics that explains the origin of everything we see in the cosmos.
And when we're talking about quantum physics, we're actually talking about subatomic particles. So we're going, instead of going big, we're going very basic parts of elements, very basic physics. In other words, the internal workings of matter.
That's exactly right. And one of the beautiful things about cosmology is that because the physics of what happened in the universe when it was very young is the physics of things at very high energies and very short distances, it provides a point where the physics of inner space, quantum mechanics, and the physics of fundamental particles meets the physics of outer space, cosmology, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and so on. They actually unify and they meet in a full circle at the first moment of time. And this provides a very, very elegant picture of the origins of the cosmos itself.
I understand one of the ways that scientists could study the Big Bang is through something called a cosmic microwave background, or CMB. What is this? How is it discovered? And how is it captured?
The cosmic microwave background is, simply put, is the light left over from the Big Bang. So the early universe would have been very hot and very dense. And in fact, it would have been like something like a thick fog. You wouldn't be able to see very far through it because the light was scattering so much off this hot, dense gas. As the gas cooled, about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe suddenly went through a transition when it went from being opaque, like a thick fog, to being transparent. Suddenly the fog cleared. And the light that was bouncing around in that hot gas that was, about half the temperature of the surface of the sun would have been freed to propagate throughout space. And that light, this glow left over from the initial hot gas, fills the entire universe. And as the universe expanded, that glow cooled, but it's still there. So what would have been visible to your eye at the time when the light was first emitted, because of the expansion of the universe since then, between when it was 400,000 years old and now at almost 14 billion, the wavelength has stretched, and now it's brightest in the microwaves. This was first discovered in 1965 by Penzias and Wilson, who were two scientists who were working for Bell Labs, and they were experimenting with microwave communications for satellites in the early days of satellite communications, and they actually detected this background noise in their antenna, and they had no idea what it was. And it was David Wilkinson and Robert Dickey at Princeton, who were two cosmologists who were actually looking for this light left over from the Big Bang at the time, immediately recognized what it was, and they were seeing this light. In fact, if you take an old school television, an old analog one, and you tune it off the channel, so what you see is static, about 1% of that static is light left over from the Big Bang itself. And that is what the cosmic microwave background is. And that actually allows us, by looking at that light, we can see what exactly what the universe looked like when it was only about 400,000 years old. We can directly observe it.
Going back to the early history of the universe, after the Big Bang, I understand the universe was bright and hot, and it lasted, I don't know, how long did this period of early universe last, where nothing else existed but this bright, hot space?
The universe gradually cooled. So, for example, the first elements were formed in nuclear reactions that happened between when the universe was between 1 second and 3 minutes old. All of the hydrogen and helium in the universe was formed by an age of about 3 minutes. The universe cooled and became transparent about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. This was when the cosmic microwave background was released. And after that, the universe entered a period called the Dark Ages, where there were no stars, there was no light being emitted, and gradually dark matter was collapsing into halos, pulling the hydrogen and helium gas into those halos along with it, gradually becoming denser and denser until finally, we don't know exactly how long, but somewhere around 200 million years after the Big Bang, the first stars formed and filled the universe with light. And this ended the Dark Ages and entered the age of the stars and the galaxies, which is where we live now.
Speaking of stars, when we're talking about the first stars that ever formed, at the time, you would have to admit there weren't many elements in the universe. There was what, hydrogen, helium, and perhaps another element as well. How did those particular stars happen to form when they didn't have the sophistication of the stars that we're seeing now? In other words, they didn't have the additional elements that current stars produce.
That's right. So all of the things that are heavier than hydrogen and helium in the universe, all the things that make us up, the carbon and the oxygen and the metals and all of these things that make up our bodies, for example, were all produced in stars, in nuclear reactions in the centers of stars. The first stars formed when there were none of these elements in the universe, only hydrogen and helium. So these stars would have been very, very different than modern stars. They would have been much larger, much brighter, and they would have had extremely short lifetimes, perhaps millions or tens of millions of years, no more, compared to the sun, which has a lifetime of almost 10 billion years. So these stars would have been huge, massive, and very short-lived, and they would have exploded very quickly into supernovas, and those explosions would have seeded the gas in the cosmos with the heavier elements that were necessary later to form stars like the ones we see today and also to form life.
So in other words, when a star reaches the end of its lifetime, especially if it's a supermassive star, it ends its life in a supernova, it explodes. And with that explosion, it throws out more sophisticated elements, such as
iron,
gold, and platinum. Have we found evidence of any newer elements that were produced by more recent supernovas?
Well, one of the interesting things is that the elements like gold and platinum, all the precious metals, for example, those were not primarily formed in supernovae. They were formed mostly in mergers of neutron stars. So neutron stars are actually these incredibly dense remnants that are left behind after supernovae occur. And these remnants sometimes orbit in and merge with each other in a cataclysmic merger that gives off, we can see them happening because of the gravitational waves they emit. This is one of the things that the LIGO telescope sees. And it is now known that most of, for example, the gold, and if you have a gold jewelry, almost all of the gold in that jewelry was formed in the mergers of two neutron stars at some distant point in the universe, which I think is really cool.
I don't know if you've seen this or not, Will, but there was a recent study from Princeton University physicists, and they proposed that the rapid expansion of the universe could slow within 65 million years and within 100 million years stop and begin to contract over billions of years until it ends and possibly is reborn again. Your thoughts?
I'm fairly skeptical of this. We have no particular evidence that the expansion of the universe is slowing down. In fact, rather the opposite. All of the evidence indicates that the expansion is speeding up. So this is an idea. It's an interesting idea, but it's a purely hypothetical one. We have no particular actual observational evidence that this is going to occur. Maybe it will. It's impossible to tell for sure.
So do you see the universe actually coming to an end? In other words, it's not an infinite universe. It does have a beginning. It does have an ending.
As far as we know, although the universe had a beginning, and this is well established and uncontroversial, the future of the universe is less well determined. But our best guess, based on what we know the universe is made of now, in particular the dark energy that is dominating the density of the universe, if this dark energy is stable, if it doesn't decay with time or have some sort of other time dependence, the conclusion you draw is that the universe will not come to any kind of an end, but it will expand infinitely. Weirdly enough, that infinite expansion will be so fast that we will ultimately find ourselves, our galaxy, alone in a completely empty space, devoid of any other galaxies. And eventually all the stars in our galaxy, after about 100 trillion years or so, the last stars in our galaxy will go out, and the end state of the universe will be cold, dark, and empty. This is our current best guess, although it's very difficult to predict things hundreds of trillions of years in advance, as you might imagine.
I've been reading that some scientists say that the Big Bang was not only the beginning of our universe, but was the ending of a previous universe, and that there were other universes even before that. Do you buy into that theory?
If you take this theory of inflation, which has, because it creates the structure in the universe that we see today, we can actually test this theory. We can match its predictions for what the structure in the universe ought to look like against what we see. If you then calculate the consequences of this, you come to find that it predicts almost inevitably that our universe is not unique, but it is one of many, many other universes that are continuously being produced out of a larger structure in a process called eternal self-reproduction. So the picture of the universe that you get from inflation at the end of the day is nothing like this little patch of the universe we live in, but that our universe is in fact one of an innumerable number of others that are constantly popping into existence in a much larger and potentially much, much older environment. So the inflationary universe could be unimaginably old and unimaginably vast, and our, what we call our universe, our entire infinite space that we live in, would be one of many, many, many others that are constantly being produced out of empty space itself. So the picture that you get is very different.
You're suggesting a multiverse, in other words.
It's basically an almost inevitable consequence of inflation itself. Yes.
And we were introduced to the concept of multiverse in the movie Interstellar.
Sure. And it's certainly a standard trope of science fiction, you know, Marvel multiverse and all of these things. So it's something that I think fires up people's imagination a lot. The multiverse of inflation, of course, it would be, as far as we know anyway, impossible to travel to these other universes because of the presence of these cosmic horizons that we talked about earlier. We're trapped within our own little horizon. And unless, for example, Einstein's theory of gravity is wrong in some fundamental way or something similar, then these other universes that may or may not be out there would be forever inaccessible to us by any conceivable measurement, observation, or way to travel to them. So it presents a cosmologist like me with an interesting problem in that we're sort of moving beyond the boundary of what you can really legitimately call a scientific hypothesis at all. If you can't ever tell whether or not that those things are out there, is it really science to suggest that they are? That's a difficult question.
Will Kinney, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and explaining some of the theories that have taken place over the years. Thank you so much today for joining
us
today.
Thanks, Rick. It's been a real pleasure.
That was William Will Kinney, a professor of physics at the University at Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences in Buffalo, New York. Professor Kinney is also the author of a newly released book that explores the origins of the universe called An Infinity of Worlds, Cosmic Inflation and the Beginning of the Universe. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Thanks for listening. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. An air raid siren was heard in central Kyiv shortly after Polish President Andrzej Duda finished speaking to Ukraine's parliament, a reminder that the nation remained at war even as the front lines have shifted hundreds of kilometers to the south and east. After ending weeks of resistance by the last Ukrainian fighters in the strategic southeastern port of Mariupol, Russia is waging a major offensive in Luhansk, one of two provinces in Donbas. Belarusians are among the foreign fighters who have volunteered to take up arms in Ukraine against Russian forces. VOA's Tommy McNeil has our story.
Many of them consider the Ukrainians defending their homeland to be their brethren. And by joining their resistance to Russia's onslaught, they hope to weaken the rule of Russian President Vladimir Putin and ultimately that of Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko. Some Russian troops were sent from Belarusian territory into Ukraine early in the war, and Lukashenko has publicly stood by longtime ally Putin, calling him his big brother. Weakening Putin, they believe, would create a window of opportunity to topple Lukashenko and bring democratic change to the nation of nearly 10 million people. Tommy McNeil, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Japan Sunday as part of his first visit to Asia as president. A central theme for the trip is to tighten U.S. alliances in the Pacific to counter China's influence in the region. Prior to Japan, Mr. Biden was in South Korea, where he thanked U.S. and South Korean service members.
Our alliance was formed through shared sacrifice of the Korean War, and now, 7 decades later, thanks to you, the Republic of Korea is strong, thriving, and innovating democracy, and our alliance grows stronger every single day.
This is VOA News. A military cargo plane carrying the first shipment of infant formula from Europe to help address a critical shortage in the United States landed in the U.S. state of Indiana Sunday, but a top government official noted that much more needs to be done. A February 17th recall by a top baby formula maker and the closing of its manufacturing plant in the U.S. state of Michigan has created one of the biggest infant formula shortages in recent U.S. history for U.S. families. Scientists who have monitored the monkeypox virus in Western Africa are baffled by its recent spread around the world. AP correspondent Karen Chamez reports.
Cases have previously been seen only among people with links to Africa, but in the past week, cases have popped up in Britain, Spain, Portugal, Sweden, the US, and Canada. Most of the reported infections have been found in young men who hadn't previously traveled to Africa. No one has so far died from the outbreak, and scientists in Britain are investigating whether the disease is being sexually transmitted. I'm Karen Chamez.
Austria's first suspected case of monkeypox has been reported in Vienna, national broadcaster ORF said Sunday, citing a spokesperson for the city's top health official. The 35-year-old man was taken to the hospital overnight with symptoms typical of the illness, ORF said, adding that tests should determine later Sunday night whether it was, in fact, monkeypox. Oman announced Sunday the lifting of all measures that had been taken to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in all venues for all activities, state TV reported, citing a statement from the government committee dealing with the pandemic. Authorities in Ethiopia's northern Amhara region have arrested 4 employees of a U.S.-based online media outlet. While the whereabouts of 2 others was unclear, the outlet said Sunday, in the latest round of arrests involving media. The arrest would add to those of 5 journalists in another Amhara media outlet on Thursday over what their colleagues said was the outlet's reporting of the activity of a local volunteer militia known as FANO. Amhara is the second most populous region in Ethiopia and a key constituency for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Northeast Bangladesh's worst floods in nearly 20 years began receding Sunday, but rescue workers were struggling to help millions marooned by extreme weather across the region that has killed around 60 people. Floods are a regular menace to millions of people in low-lying Bangladesh and neighboring northeast India, but many experts say climate change is increasing the frequency, ferocity, and unpredictability. And recapping our top story, an air raid siren was heard in central Kyiv shortly after Polish President Andrzej Duda finished speaking to Ukraine's parliament. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The public is expecting so much from him because the buck stops at him. While we may indeed expect these law enforcement agents and SCB to act, but obviously we would also want to hear his words on these final findings, and obviously should be able to address the nation.
Malawi civil society and human rights groups demand an inquiry into a report detailing corruption in the government allocation of funds to combat the coronavirus.
And we have those that are prepared to go and set it up for themselves while they are being held on two hands by the SME ministry, the science and technology ministry, as well as the local government ministry that is providing the resources through the CDF.
Zambia's Minister for Labor and Social Security says the administration is implementing measures to create meaningful jobs for the youth.
7 to 15 years, we shouldn't be surprised if China moves ahead and establishes more military facilities on the continent. It should not come as a surprise, judging from the current trajectory of Chinese interest and the expansion of Chinese activities on the continent.
An analyst or expert say it appears China is considering establishing a second naval base in Africa on the Atlantic coast. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Malawi, civil society and human rights groups are demanding an immediate investigation into a report detailing corruption in the government's allocation of funds to combat the coronavirus. This after an audit showed that about $4.7 million of the $21 million of funds to help stop the spread of the disease cannot be accounted for. It adds to the $881 million that could not be accounted for in the first phase of the 2021 study. The findings were contained in a report compiled by Malawi's Auditor General. The groups say those responsible for the alleged misappropriation of funds should be held accountable for their actions. They argue that the alleged embezzlement contributed to COVID-related deaths at the height of the pandemic. Meanwhile, President Lazarus Chakwera has vowed to crack down on those he says are responsible for the alleged graft. For more reaction, I reach Robert Nkwazalemba. He is the chairperson of the Human Rights Consultative Committee.
So there are a number of NGOs that have risen to say we would want action to be done. You may wish to recall that an initial report was released earlier this year, and there were some talks, but government said we would want to wait until we get a final report from the Auditor General. And then some people were suspended, others arrested, some district commissioners. But with this final report being out and confirming the initial report findings, people are saying heads must roll.
Should the Anti-Corruption Bureau, tasked with investigating financial malfeasance or the embezzlement of public funds, be in charge of this? Because sometimes some people say that the anti-corruption group is being used to persecute opponents of the administration. So who should tackle this investigation?
Well, it's on two fronts. You have abuses based on issues to do with subsistence allowance. That is, people being paid the multiple allowances for perhaps for not doing anything. And then you have other issues to do with misprocurements, where you have state entities, the internal procurement committees, colluding to defraud government, either by giving false figures or inflated figures. So obviously there are two elements. You have the police have to deal with perhaps the issue of subsistence allowance claims, and then you have to further do investigations and prosecute institutions that are involved in misprocurements, that is, the inflation of figures and the like. They need to find out what was the motive, who was behind it, so that they are brought to book. So if such issues are brought to police, they, to an extent, lack capacity to understand the motive behind such misprocurements, because if there is collusion, parties spoke and they agreed to supply others,
And then you also get to find some decisions that were made midway. They were assigned, the initial project was to procure medicine, drugs, issues of sanitizer. But midway, they changed the focus of what the money should be used for. So the person behind the decision to say, can we change course of the project, those people have to be brought to book. So yes, SCB has to be invoked. It may have been overstretched or it is being overstretched, but it has to come in on those aspects. Well, police also have to do their part. So we would not want to agree with the elements that perhaps SCB is being used to persecute individuals, maybe from the previous administration, if that may be put in that context. But would like to say we understand SCB has moved fast on a few individuals, political individuals, simply because there is evidence that is available. Corruption prosecution is not a small task. So where they have evidence and confirmed the trail of abuse or corruption, that's why they have moved fast. And unfortunately, it seems to be addressed to those individuals that were in the previous administration. That's how it's being misunderstood. But we do appreciate and understand that SCB is working based on the information that they have so far gathered on such allegations.
President Lazarus Chakwera has vowed to crack down. What are the expectations of him to undertake this promise to crack down on those responsible for the alleged embezzlement?
Obviously, he may not want to be seen to be overlapping his responsibilities. He believes in the high five where the rule of law is one arm of his principles. So he would want state institutions to undertake action. Initially, when he acted, where he fired some district commissioners and the like, the magistrate courts found them not wrong and they were reinstated. Obviously, people would have concluded that the president acted wrongly, overstepped his mandate. So we are seeing a scenario where he would say, I tried my part, but the system, justice system, let me down. These people appeared. So based on the final report, let the law enforcement agents act. So obviously, you'll be looking at the police to prosecute and the SCB to take up those matters that are involving individuals where corruption has been detected. So I would say he maintains his stand that he is ready to clap on corruption. The public is expecting so much from him because backstops at him. While we may indeed expect these law enforcement agents and SCB to act, but obviously we would also want to hear his words on these final findings, and obviously should be able to address the nation.
Robert Nkwazalemba is the chairperson of the Human Rights Consultative Committee. He spoke with me from Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. Zambia's Minister for Labour and Social Security says President Hakainde Hichilema's administration has implemented measures to recruit 30,000 teachers and 11,000 nurses before the end of the year. Brenda Tambatamba says he has created an enabling business environment to encourage Zambians to invest and to attract foreign investors in mining and other sectors of the economy. Her remarks follow President Hakainde Hichilema's call for a concerted effort to improve the operating environment of the mining sector. His call came during a speech at the annual African Mining Indaba, recently held in Cape Town, South Africa. For more on the labor market in Zambia, I reach Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister Brenda Tambatamba via Skype. In part two of my interview with her, Tambatamba addresses concerns by youth groups that government is failing to keep its promises to quickly create jobs for them.
We have got a responsibility to take Zambia out of the doldrums of the debt situation that the PF government entrenched this nation in. So social safety net, managing the debt situation, which is would became almost unsustainable. And so we've checked, we have assessed, we've done risk assessments, plausible ideas of the best way to manage the debt situation. And so we are negotiating a program with the IMF to restructure the debt so that it doesn't obstruct our agenda to cater to the needs of our people, to creating the jobs that are so much needed. So our people are being communicated to, including communicating to them about the alternatives that are in place that they can utilize in the short term and the midterm while we are pursuing more sustainable long-term economic recovery measures that will yield the kind of jobs, the meaningful jobs that have been demonstrated in the jobs that have been provided, procured for the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education and many more. Including the fact that we are also looking at the social security packages of those that have gone without their pensions during the same time, the past 10 years, who were never paid their pension.
What entails in this safety net? And for those who are not in the health or education industry where the jobs have been created, like you mentioned, what happens to them?
The SME Development Ministry is seated there together with the Ministry of Science and Technology to ensure that they provide a framework for training, for upskilling those that are wishing to go into self-employment.
What kind of training?
Vocational training.
Okay.
Yes, vocational skills training. And so this is the framework that we have. The two ministries are working together with the Ministry of Labor and Social Security, my ministry, to ensure that we are also catering to those that may be crossing from formal employment to go and set up their small businesses that will grow eventually. And that is also complemented by the CDF, the Constituency Development Fund, that has grown exponentially, unprecedented growth. Of that fund from 1.6 million kwacha to 25 million kwacha. This money has two components that these who are being trained can tap from. By the way, there's a component that can give a bursary, that will afford a bursary to those who want to go to the vocational skills training programs. And so that is the social safety net that has been provided. Money for bursaries for vocational training, money for to be borrowed by those who are coming out of vocational schools to go and set up their small enterprises, and also a provision for training that is coming from SME Development, continuously carrying them along to train them on financial inclusiveness and many other facets that are important for them to grow their businesses, their small businesses, medium-scale businesses, into responsible, big, growing, you know, developing businesses that will one day become, they will one day mature to become private sector players of the future. Even the CEO of Barrick was quoted as expressing themselves, commenting that there is now a better investment climate in Zambia that will attract even their rethinking about participating, just like the FQM has done. So Barrick too, we count on them that they'll be looking. They will be looking to probably expanding their property in Lumwana, while there'll be newcomers that are coming on the block that will also cater to those who are who prefer to recruit and to be recruited to get employed in the mining sector again. So we have those investors that are coming in, absorbing some of those who are falling off from those that are adjusting, who are going through some business restructuring at the moment. And we have those that are prepared to go and set it up for themselves while they are being held on two hands by the SME Ministry, the Science and Technology Ministry, as well as the local government ministry that is providing the resources through the CDF.
Brenda Tambatamba is Zambia's Labour and Social Security Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Analysts or experts say it appears China is considering establishing a second naval base in Africa on the Atlantic coast. They also say due to China's routine denial about its intentions, its credibility in Africa has drawn mixed reaction. This after China on many occasions denied it was establishing a military base in Djibouti. Experts say the yet-to-be-established base will help China project strength and power on the global stage. But the African Union has cautioned its member states not to sign agreements that enable developed nations to establish military bases in their respective countries. Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, recently penned an article about China's speculated plan to establish a second naval base in Africa. I reached him for more on the latest on China's plans.
What my report does is it tries to explain China's thinking in terms of basing scenarios. It provides insight into why China is pursuing expeditionary capabilities. It looks at the record of behavior and the record of practice in terms of indicators that might suggest potential scenarios and options that China might settle for on the African continent. It doesn't exactly state where China is going next, but what it does or what China is going to do, because that is very difficult and frankly, it is impossible. However, it provides a set of indicators that policy analysts, researchers, military scholars and decision makers can use to be able to try and get a better understanding about China's basing doctrine, China's basing practices, and the record of past behavior.
Some say what is wrong with a China decision to establish yet another naval base in Africa, especially when other world powers have military bases in Africa?
I mentioned this in my report, that other countries have got bases, United States, United Kingdom. I mentioned the United Kingdom one because it's a really huge presence in Kenya, and it's a presence that China does not come anywhere close to having that kind of presence in Africa. You cannot even compare the base that China has in Djibouti and the presence the British Army has had in Kenya since independence. Africans have had a very complicated relationship and a very complicated history with foreign intervention. And foreign intervention and the establishment of bases, whether it's done by China or whether it's done by the US or Russia, tends to be frowned upon by Africans. And some of the evidence that can be cited, and which indeed is cited in the report, is the AU decision. The AU has taken a decision, the AU Peace and Security Council took a decision, first of all, expressing concern and warning member countries to be careful about signing agreements that will establish more foreign bases on the continent.
Paul, some people have also questioned China's thought process, because sometimes they shroud what they want to do in some cloud or mystery, or don't really detail what they plan to do until the last minute or when it is done before they know. Does this really undermine what they plan to do in terms of the projection of power or try to make friends on the international stage?
I think it does. So yes, indeed. Anytime any story comes up concerning the potential establishment of a Chinese base, African observers tend to go back to that Djibouti experience, and they tend to argue that, listen, China denied this up until the very last minute, so why should we believe? If China then comes up and says, no, we don't have any plans, for instance, to build a base, just out of argument's sake, in Namibia or Kenya or Tanzania, because these are countries that have been cited in the past, then local actors then say, okay, why should we believe you? Because when it came to Djibouti, we saw exactly what happened. So yes, indeed, it does create credibility problems for China. It does create credibility problems. It does create image problems. But I think it will be important to note that just judging from the growth and the expansion of China's geostrategic footprint on the continent, which is growing day by day. You already have over 10,000 Chinese firms on the continent. About 2,000-3,000 of them are state-owned enterprises. You have all these high-value investments that are being put in place. You also have a growing number of military-to-military cooperation agreements with different African countries. An expansion of Chinese participation in peacekeeping operations. My guess is that within the next 7 to 15 years, we shouldn't be surprised if China moves ahead and establishes more military facilities on the continent, it should not come as a surprise, judging from the current trajectory of Chinese interest and the expansion of Chinese activities on the continent.
Paul Nantulia is a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Sonny. The Men's Basketball Africa League finals continue on Sunday with two quarterfinal games at the Kigali Arena in Rwanda. Joining us now from Kigali to tell us more is VOA Sonny Young. Spotted greetings, Sonny.
What's the atmosphere been like at the Kigali Arena?
Well, Peter, on Saturday at the Kigali Arena, there was a near-capacity crowd of almost 10,000. I did see a few empty seats. Great atmosphere, Peter. The FAP fans from Cameroon were waving the Cameroon flag. The supporters of Rwanda Energy Group, they had trumpets and drums, singing and dancing. I thought it was a wonderful atmosphere. However, the team from Cameroon, FAP, did prevail by a score of 66-63 and left many of the hometown Rwanda fans very disappointed. In the opening day game on Saturday, Petro de Luanda from Angola, one of the continental powers in African men's basketball, they defeated AS Saleh of Morocco by a score of 102-89. Carlos Moraes with a game high 27 points for Petro de Luanda.
Well, Sonny, this new Basketball Africa League is in its second year of existence. Do you think it will grow in terms of participating teams and host cities?
Peter, just to review a little bit, last year, the Basketball Africa League held its inaugural season, and it was basically a compressed two-week schedule here in Kigali at the same Kigali Arena. And this time around, they changed the format a bit for the second season. The games began in March in Dakar, Senegal, and then they moved to Cairo, Egypt in April. And now they've wound up here in Kigali for the Basketball Africa League finals. So we had three African cities participating in season 2022 of the Basketball Africa League. I think it is possible, Peter, that we will see more African cities hosting games down the road and, you know, more African countries for that matter. I know other African countries have expressed interest in hosting the Basketball Africa League games. There are infrastructure questions. Is the arena suitable for hosting games? But yes, I think we're going to see more teams. This time around, the league started with a total of 12 teams. And even one of the teams that's participating on Sunday here in Kigali, the Cape Town Tigers, I've spoken with their coach, Relton Boyson, and he has predicted maybe in a year or two that there could be as many as 20 teams, maybe even more, participating in the Basketball Africa League. So, yes, Peter, I think there is room for future growth.
So, Sonny, what's the impact of the league's partners, talking about the National Basketball Association, the NBA, and FIBA, the International Basketball Federation?
Huge impact, Peter, especially the NBA. I think the NBA really is the driving force for this new Basketball Africa League. The NBA is financing the league. They have even sent some of their organizational people here to Rwanda to help out with media credentialing, hospitality. I think the NBA is definitely, it has a huge impact on the success of this league. I can't underscore enough the financial impact that the NBA